Again, thank you for coming back. We're on our third of five, and today is legal traditions and institutions in primarily the Old Testament. I have been following this Brevard Childs book and got the topics from that, so I'm not sure this is one I would have picked, but it's ended out having a lot of material to mine, which I'm glad of. So let's start with a prayer, and then I'm going to ask Amy to make, I think Amy wants to make an announcement after the opening prayer. So let us pray. Dear God, again, we give you thanks for the opportunity to gather and think about our common life together as members of a community and a tradition of faith, and also as citizens of one of the republics, one of the nations of the world. We do hope that this material you've given us in Scripture, in all of its depth and the centuries it covers, speaks to us in our time and gives us permission and freedom to acknowledge that sometimes we face things for which we cannot find direct answers in this book, but give you thanks for its accumulated wisdom that might bring us to some measure of wisdom today. In the name of Christ we pray, amen. So Amy wants to make an announcement. She's our Director of Adult Education here.
Just two quick things. One, the reason that we ask you to sign the clipboard before you come to adult ed is it really does help the committee put together what subjects we may be teaching in the classes for the following year. And they follow, you know, who comes to which type of class. So I know sometimes it seems like it's not being used, but we really do use the information. So just wanted to encourage you to sign in when you come. And the other thing is we are going to have a panel of experts on anxiety disorders and OCD. It's going to be a Thursday evening, October 17th in this room. And just encourage anybody that's interested in that. We're sponsored by the Mid-Atlantic OCD group, but also the small mental health group that we have that meets periodically here in Westminster. So hope you'll come and support that. And with that,
all right. Thank you. So I started this one with just a series of questions that arose in my mind from, you know, from preparing this lesson and reading about it. So I'll just sort of read these and ask you to ponder them as we go. I don't promise to address them all in here. But one is the question of, you know, if what is right according to the will and way of God versus what's embodied in any society's laws. That obviously is going to vary considerably society to society, but it's always an individual issue, particularly in a free society as ours, of what God requires us to do versus what may or may not be embodied in a society's laws. I'm also interested in sort of three different things that occur in society. One is the law, legal traditions, what you have to do to follow the law. Another are the more broad category of just social norms, ranging from manners to expectations of the way we treat each other to the way we act that may not be codified in law. And then the third issue is just the individual. What does the individual do that is right and according to the will of God, even apart from what the law may say or our social norms may say? So I think those are distinctions to keep in mind. What are the differences between being legal and ethical? In this city, we see that all the time. You know, something can be, well, I didn't break the law. It doesn't have to be ethical, but, you know, you can't prosecute me. For Christians and Jews and people of religious traditions, what's the difference between being legal and faithful? It's helpful when we can follow our faith, and that also means we're following the law, but it doesn't always work out that way. And then one would think that there's not a difference between being ethical and faithful, but sometimes your faith even comes in conflict with ethics of a society or of a religious tradition. Something we wrestle with in this country is what laws of society are legitimate for protecting religious practices, allowing them, versus advancing them and supporting them with the law of the state. And again, in America, we've got a great tradition of religious freedom, but at the same time, there are some practices that actually advance religions or particular religions. And something that I was aware of, way back in college, is when should society's laws override specific religious practices or beliefs? When I went to college at the University of Arkansas, and I remember there was a case going on at the time in the 70s of a mountain family who did not believe in medical care. And they weren't Church of Christ, but it was some kind of religious cult. And they were actually, I think, successfully prosecuted by the local officials for essentially child neglect, and maybe it may have been a manslaughter case or something, I can't remember, but just refusing to take their child to a doctor. And, you know, that's a heavy instance of when the power of the law might override an individual religious belief. Certainly in recent years, we've seen, you know, the baking wedding cakes versus same-sex marriages, medical treatment for minors against parental religious beliefs, or just the whole thing. We also saw 5 or 6 years ago when the Affordable Care Act came in, about just the extent to which we as a society are legally allow opting out of funding for abortion, and my understanding is that abortion's never been funded by the federal health insurance or the federal policies with the Hyde amendments, but the whole debate of allowing Catholic hospitals and charities to opt out of even providing health insurance for that has abortion policies is again an issue where an individual religious tradition and a society, the laws of society, can conflict. Another question, I told you I'm not going to answer all these, I'm just throwing these out for you to think about. When should religious practices be binding on a religious community as determined by that community, but not on society? That's essentially what we have in now that same-sex marriage is the law of the land. There are many religious communities that do not recognize same-sex marriage and won't do them. So that's where where the society doesn't bind a religious tradition to do something that it doesn't believe in. But a larger issue, or not a larger issue, but a lengthier issue on that is the whole issue of military service. We're aware of, and we'll have some discussion next week of just, denominations and religious traditions that are essentially pacifist. And so it is wrong for, or it is against the faith of those members to be drafted or serve in the military. And the way we've always gotten around that here is either conscientious objection or alternative service. But again, that's a situation where the laws of the land and individual religious practice may differ. Another question that I didn't write down here, but that I've thought a lot about, especially, we'll talk about it a little bit later, I guess, but I'm always aware of how important it is, particularly in a divided political atmosphere, as to whether or not a law is going to work, and the importance of, should legislative time and capital be spent on trying to get a law passed that is not necessarily going to be that effective. I mean, I didn't grow up in Texas, but I spent 11 years in Texas, in telling Texans to wear seat belts or motorcycle helmets is like telling them to, start rooting for the Yankees or something. I mean, they're just not going to do it, that's one way of looking at that. But I frankly think that, in my lifetime as a minister, we have essentially I mean, we have legalized casinos beyond Las Vegas, which I think is the only place they were legal. You know, when I started in the ministry, I don't even think Atlantic City was legal when I started in the ministry. And certainly, you know, we are now legalizing marijuana. We're certainly legalizing lotteries, and gambling is just expanding, you know, by beaucoups. And I think it's an important question in frankly the whole wrestling that we're doing as a society right now on the gun issue. I mean, I think there are certainly many ways in which certain types of gun restrictions or controls are less effective than we would like to think they would be. But at the same time, is there a role for society to pass legislation that may have some kind of moral statement of that society's identity, even if it's not necessarily all that effective? I ask that question. I've never really seen anybody else ask it, but I'm interested in that question. We certainly have a terrible example of that in Prohibition. I mean, I guess it was a terrible example in that it apparently didn't work, and what, we repealed it after, I don't know, 7 years or something. Paul? That's interesting. That is great, Paul. I'm so glad we have a world traveler here. I would have never known that about China or been aware of that distinction if you had not brought that up today. So thank you. Thank you for that. Anyway, I just throw those questions out. I don't promise that any of the material that's coming will necessarily answer them, but I think it's stuff to think about. I think it's important to think about. So the following material in terms of the Bible is taken almost all directly from Brevard Childs, because again, this is a topic I would not have even thought about, but once I got into it, there's more there than I realized. And this is essentially going to be a survey of the role of the law and legal institutions in the Old Testament. I'll have very little to say about the New Testament today. So few institutions within Israel played such an important role as those concerning the exercise of law. He says at every stage of Israel's history, there was explicit concern with legal matters, and at no time was Israel's faith abstracted from the concrete practice of law. I very much affirm the second part of that statement. The thing I love about the Old Testament and Judaism and the, you know, the religion of the Jews all the way passed down is that it is a non-spiritualized religion, in that you look at Judaism and you do not separate body from spirit or spirit from matter. It is a very earthy, on the ground, historic, what you do in this life matters. It's when we got into the Platonic distinction between forms and earthly embodiments, between matter and spirit, as Christianity morphed into the Greco-Roman world, that we get this division that's still so prominent in Christianity, of the life of the spirit superior to the life of the flesh and all that. And what I love about Judaism is you don't have that distinction. I don't know that, I think Childs may be overstating it a little bit to say that at every stage of Israel's history, there was explicit concern with legal matters. I think there was a lot of concern with obeying the word of God by Abraham and Sarah, but the legal traditions didn't really start to develop until after the Exodus in the Old Testament. But that's a little bit, there were certainly some social norms that Abraham followed and some that he violated that were important. So although the Old Testament is filled with long sections of laws, I always tell people who, you know, set out to read the Bible cover to cover, they get to Genesis, they get through the Exodus, and then they hit the Ten Commandments and they applaud, and then there are about 3.5 books of laws. And very few people make it through that. Second half of Exodus just kind of does you in. Then you get into Leviticus. And for Christians, that's like reading the phone book. So most people give up. But while there are a lot of laws, there are very few descriptions about how about the structures of law, a court system, legal institutions, legislative bodies, things like that are kind of hard to come by. Another thing that I learned a long time ago, and as much in New Testament as in Old Testament, is, and if you think about it, it makes sense, but just because there is a law that we read about in the Bible or a practice that we read about doesn't mean it was actually in force or followed in every time and place and community that's represented in the Bible. And that's an important practice, because we don't, you know, when we're reading a biblical story in the New Testament or the Old Testament, just because there appears to have been a legal tradition reflected in that text, it may have been fairly localized. Just like we don't really, an example, we don't really know how widespread the torture or persecution of Christians was during the time of the Apostle Paul. I mean, we know there's some, but, you know, how much of that was sort of state-oriented versus some village chieftain? You know, we just don't really have the data to know. And it's sort of true about legal material, too. We'll come across these laws in the Old Testament that seem hideous to us, and the reality is they may not have been actually followed or enforced or that widespread. But by culling bits and pieces of information, as I always like to do, from the narratives, one can sort of reconstruct the forms and history of legal institutions within the people of Israel. And so what I'm going to show you kind of for the rest of my time talking here is pretty much narrative material that a side benefit of reading it is you get a flavor for the laws or practices that may have been in society. And one of the ones that I want to point out is that lovely story in Genesis 34, which is the rape of Dinah. This is later in the book of Genesis, and I'm just going to pick up at verse 25 and read this. So it's gruesome, but this is where Jacob had 12 sons and I think 4 or 5 daughters, and the 12 sons were by 4 different women, 2 wives and 2 maids, who were given because both wives were having, or Rachel, the favored wife, was having fertility issues. So what he's got is a very blended family of a lot of half siblings, half brothers, and that shows up in here. And what happened is Dinah, who is his daughter, is raped by one of his sons, I believe it's Shechem, who is a half sister to her, and her 2 blood brothers, Simeon and Levi, exact vengeance on the rapist, partially because Jacob wouldn't. So they take matters into their own hands. So all of that has happened, you know, at this point. And now Jacob, the vengeance involves fooling them into a mass circumcision, if you can imagine that. Just go read the story. So the story picks up on the 3rd day after the vengeance has happened, this blood vengeance has happened, when those who were circumcised are still in pain. 2 of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, take their swords and came against the city unawares and killed all the males of the city. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword, and they took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. They basically, you know, raided and rescued their sister. And then the other sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and they plundered the city. And again, this is my italics. Why? Because their sister had been defiled. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field. All their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and made their prey. Then Jacob, the father, says to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." Jacob is basically saying, look, folks, we are a minority. The Canaanites rule over this. You have put us in danger by exacting this vengeance on your sister. That is what Jacob is saying. And the response, which I love on a lot of different levels, from the two brothers who have carried this out is, but the two brothers say, "Should our sister be treated as a whore?" That is the end of the story. Doesn't answer the question. Sort of floats out there. It's this story in the book of Genesis that kind of appears from nowhere. It's slightly related to what comes before and slightly related to what comes from afterwards. But it is a question that floats out, I think, for the reader to answer. Who is right on this? Are either of them right? Should our sister be treated as a whore? That's not a legal answer, but it's a human answer in both its desire for vengeance and its desire for justice. And sometimes those two are hard to tell apart. But it raises the question, when does one submit to a society or its laws out of recognition of its actual power? Which is basically what Jacob does. I mean, he submits to the law and the tradition of not taking vengeance, even though his daughter's been raped, out of a recognition of the power dynamics. The sons refuse to do that. They take matters into their own hand and are not really concerned about the power dynamics. Why they treated our sister as a whore? Should we let that pass? It raises both questions. And it's a gruesome story, but I do think it leads me to ask two questions or to make two observations in the vast sense of, you know, changes that we've had again in my lifetime. I think I go back to this question, I just came in by virtue of birth to the very sort of end. Some of the hard work in the civil rights movement was done, you know, before I was born, and certainly I've never had to really do it myself. But one of the things I'm wondering, I mean, I know from having known some older Southern white folks that the fact that in the 60s, 50s and 60s, our laws finally recognized equality, essentially. I have a feeling that our society recognized it legal helped slightly change the hearts of some people who sort of needed the government and the society to codify something in order to change. It didn't change them totally. They may have been Jacob just saying, well, I've got to accept it. But my sense is that that this was an instance where society's laws helped shape the moral fabric of society. I'm strictly saying that intuitively. My feeling is that some of that is happening today with just the acceptance the broad acceptance, or the acceptance, broadly speaking, of homosexuality, whether it's gay marriage or now transgender. My hunch is that the fact that society, through its laws, has moved in that direction has led many to be like Jacob and just sort of recognize that as the reality, even though they don't personally agree with it, and has led others to a more open position than they might have had the laws not changed. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there for you all to think about, and sort of giving intuitive. I'm giving my own intuition about this. So I'm thinking that sometimes that's a way law functions, to help the human heart change. Other times the law just functions to not run a red light because you don't want to get a ticket without changing your heart. Yes.
But in Jacob's case, they had made an offer to try to make things right. We proposed to intermarry.
Yeah.
So even though rape first and marriage later is not preferred.
Right.
You still have an attempt to try to make things right.
Right.
As opposed to just saying, we did it, and what are you going to do
about it? Yeah, you're right. You're right on that. And one of the neat interpretations of a lot of the Old Testament, especially this period, is as gruesome as the book is to us, there were a lot of times the people of Israel ended out with diplomatic solutions to things, as opposed to wholesale warfare. There were tribal wars, to be sure. But Paul, State Department guy. I mean, there was a lot of times, just like in Laban and Jacob's relationship, they ended out coming to agreements that were settled short of massive national violence. So in that, I think you raise a good point. So since we don't have much time, we're going to go on to the next story, and we'll see how much we can discuss before. I'm not preaching today, so I'll leave you. I don't have to, have a few little more minutes. So in the period of the judges, there appears to be some legal forces that were operative beyond the clan laws. During the period of the judges, Israel was pretty much organized into clans. And there's this story, I'll just tell the story, in 1 Samuel 14, of Saul's rash oath, where they're about to go into battle, and Saul makes a bargain with God. Can you remember what it is? But he knows that one of his troops has done something wrong. And so in verse 39, Saul says, "For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, even if it is my son Jonathan who gets caught to have been the wrongdoer, he shall surely die. Well, lo and behold, it's Jonathan that did it." And in the last italics, and Saul said, "Cast a lot between me and my son Jonathan." And Jonathan was taken. And being the good and faithful general that he was, Saul said, "Then Jonathan, you will surely die." But, because you got to follow an oath. You make an oath in Hebrew society, and you got to follow it. So even if it's his own son, ironically, who was caught with his hand in the cookie jar, I forget what the story is, then Saul's going to have to die. In this instance, Jonathan is so popular that the people come to Saul and say, "Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great military victory in Israel? Perish the thought," they say, "as the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked for God today." And then it says, "So the people ransomed Jonathan, and he did not die. And Saul withdrew from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place." So this all this raises for me, these are questions that this story raises. And I may be the only one whose mind goes off in these crazy directions, but when in it raises the question, when is the leader's value to the community, in this case, Jonathan, more important than the crime or the misdeed they have committed? You know, this occurs in churches, it occurs in businesses, it occurs in offices. It can cover a multitude of sins and misdeeds and excuses. But it's important. I remember during the Clinton impeachment, watching C-SPAN or something, which I do, and seeing the president, I think he was the president at the time, it may have been after he was out of office, introduced at an African-American event by a black preacher, introducing Clinton and saying, "We judge him by his stride, not his stumble." And that is a lovely phrase. I mean, apart from what you think about impeachment and Clinton and all that, it is a lovely and eloquent phrase. We judge him by his stride, not his stumble, which is sort of what they were saying about Jonathan. I also remember I think in the 90s when I think it was an author named Clayton Carson, a biographer of Martin Luther King, was sort of the first person that really documented exhaustively all of Martin Luther King's marital infidelities, which were not slight or not, they were numerous. And I remember Jean Bethke Elstein, who was a pretty conservative ethicist at the time, who no longer is living, in an article she said, because she really was a fan of Martin Luther King's, and she said, "The meaning of a life like his cannot be exhausted or reduced to his sexual infidelities." You know, at the same time, as I think I've said this in the pulpit, but I've certainly said it in classes, I have spent a lot of time in my preaching and teaching career with David. I mean, I think he is an utterly fascinating character. I did the men's retreat on him when I first came here. I preached two straight summers of sermons on David in the early 2000s, and I can't preach him since the Me Too movement. I was actually planning to return to him when all of the Me Too movement started, and I don't want to spend the rest of my career avoiding him, but I don't know what to say about David in this Me Too movement, you know, in light of this Me Too movement. So all of this is part of the challenge of the slippery slope. And I don't promise answers. I just think these questions get raised by these narratives, you know. So let's go to the power of the monarchy. The establishment of the monarchy brought, I'm on page 5 now, brought major changes in the legal system, with new powers accruing to the king. And I don't mean to just use Bill Clinton and Martin Luther King as examples. We certainly face these questions today with the White House and everything else, and statues to good bureaucrats, Paul. Okay, so, which it's a joy to work at Westminster, because I think we're full of good bureaucrats, believe me. So when you get into the kingly system, with new powers accruing to the king, this will get at your question, Paul, or your observation. King Saul's reign marked a period of transition because he was the first king, and he was not a welcome king either by God or Samuel, or for very long by the people of Israel. But several of the stories reflect legal proceedings, and one of them is, in a battle, this is 1 Samuel 22, the king Saul said to the guard who stood by him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David," who was a military threat to Saul. "They knew that David fled, and they did not disclose it to me." The priests of the Lord were probably a group of court priests that would have had access to Saul. "But the servants of the king would not raise their hand to attack the priests of the Lord." They refused to do this. They were bureaucrats who refused to obey a king's order. "Then the king said to Doeg, you, Doeg, turn and attack the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned and attacked the priests. On that day he killed 85 who wore the linen ephod. Nob, the city of the priests, was put to the sword. Men and women, children and infant, oxen, donkeys, and sheep were put to the sword. Aren't you glad you came today? Sorry, but a lot of the legal material is about violence. So the question is that it raises, which, you know, I know that some of you face this and certainly know that people do. When do public servants at any level refuse to carry out the order of a ruler which they consider to be illegal, immoral, or the result of the ruler's mental instability? Saul was mentally unstable. There's no question about that. There were a lot of reasons for that, including God being stacked against him from the beginning. But Saul's short reign is just marked by a decline in his mental faculties. And the question is, when do you obey that order? And when do you not? The priest didn't. Doeg did. End of the story. It's like many biblical stories. The question floats in the room for you to answer and wrestle with in your community of faith and among your friends. So now we get to wisdom literature, because I really do want to leave you all time to talk. I'm glad wisdom literature is toward the end of the Bible, because it's my favorite. I'll just come to this one that's different than the one we used last week, which was also good. This is Proverbs 16:10-15. It's a wisdom saying that depicts an ideal king whose judgments and rule and rulings and decisions appear to be inspired by God. So it reads, "Inspired decisions are on the lips of a king. His mouth does not sin in judgment. Among the inspired decisions, honest balances and scales are the Lord's. All the weights in the bag are his work." That is essentially their accounting system. That's saying the management of money and wealth and the king's treasury is honest. That's the balances and scales. Next, "It is an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness." My off-the-hand, exegesis of that is to say that the office of the king has been established by God in and for righteousness, and it is an abomination for an occupant of that office not to live up to it. I think it's what it's saying here. Righteous lips are the delight of a king, and he loves those who speak what is right. In wisdom literature, what you say matters. 14. "A king's wrath is a messenger of death, and whoever is wise will appease it." Essentially, in some ways, that's what Jacob was doing. Wasn't a king, but essentially, that's what Jacob was doing. And that may contradict what we said before. I don't promise you consistency, especially in the Bible. "In the light of a king's face there is life, and his favor is like the clouds that bring the spring rain." A ruler who brings life is like cloud, is like spring rain. It's beautiful. It's refreshing. It's inspiring. It's uplifting. So my question, how important is it for the ruler to be honest and decent and at the same time effective? We sort of asked that earlier. What happens when a leader, a ruler, is effective but dishonest and indecent? Or is ineffective but honest and decent? I think we've seen a little bit of both. My opinion, the standards, and this is what I really do believe, the standards for rulers, military, and public servants are enormously important. And Paul, we should have statues to honest bureaucrats. I agree with, I mean, doesn't work.
We don't need them.
Right. But I mean, I really, one of the, and I, you know, I've probably always overestimated the moral condition of my congregations. I mean, I am sort of a, I'm not a see no evil person, but I really do trust people. And there was a, I don't know, I remember way, way back when I was a teenager, there was some, y'all remember Mad Magazine? And there was some cover of how does your priest see you? How does your minister see you? How does your accountant see you? How does your, you know, yard man see you? I don't know. There were some 20 of them. And, you know, I do tend to see you all probably sometimes through rose-colored lenses or want to. But I also think, I mean, I really, really do admire and appreciate the character of most people in this congregation. And I think you probably carry that character to the absolute best of your ability into public and military service. But I think you ought to. I mean, I am just, I'm sure I would be terrible as a bureaucrat, but I can't imagine if you serve a country, it's just like serving a church. If you are not morally at your best, whether it's in honesty, whether it's in, you know, your commitment to your job, or whether it's in your financial honesty, I don't think you got any business in the business. And I think most of you all do that. I really do. But I hope so. I want to read, I want to go back to, to 17, two more things. So Deuteronomy, I'm on page 7 now, Deuteronomy 17, 18 through 20. I just think this is a beautiful passage that I'd never noticed before. When the king has taken the throne of his kingdom, I love this. Now I realize that this is how the law can function for a king. He shall have a copy of this law, and this law is the Jewish Torah in Deuteronomy, written for him in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall remain with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to fear, respect the Lord his God, diligently observing all the words of this law and these statutes, neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandment, either to the right or to the left, so that he and his descendants may reign long over his kingdom in Israel. I just love that standard for a leader. This is a great passage, especially if we take law in the largest and most personally adaptable sense of faith or moral health. Have a copy of the law written for the leader. It shall remain with him or her. He or she shall read it all the days of her life. He shall learn to fear the Lord his God through it, and presumably through the tremendous responsibilities of his or her rule. Neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandment. And yet the reason, it's not simply for moral purity or soundness, but so that his descendants may reign long over his kingdom in Israel. There is some sense of promise that the character and morality and faithfulness of the leader does have practical implications for the health of the country and the people, especially over the long haul. Jehoshaphat's, one of the king's, admonition to his newly appointed judges reflects this consistent theological perspective in the whole Old Testament. Jehoshaphat saying to the judges, consider what you do, for you judge not only for man or humanity, but for the Lord. He is with you in giving judgment. And finally, and we will have time for good questions today, the rise of the monarchy, which happened, you know, later, I mean, with about 1000 BCE, gave rise for increased potential for abuse of the law by the king. And it was a main source of continuous friction between the prophet and the king. Obviously, once you get a monarchy, just the size of the government and the rule and the number of bureaucrats and the reach of the ruler was greater than it was under the judges, under the tribal periods, and there was more opportunity for abuse. And frankly, as the prophets critiqued the kings, it led them fairly late in Israel's history, 500 or so, to develop the hope for and promise of the Messiah. Out of some sense that no earthly ruler can save us. We cannot be saved by our earthly rulers. But much of the Messiahship, the early expectations of the Messiah were kingly or monarchical in their nature. And one of the reasons, Jesus met a little resistance along the way is he didn't live up to that more political kingly understanding of the Messiah. But some of the language is beautiful. For example, Isaiah 11:3-4, in terms of how it depicts the Messiah as being different than the kings they are experiencing at the time. The Messiah shall delight in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, decide with equity for the meek of the earth, shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. We get a little bit of the Battle Hymn of the Republic from that. So then in the New Testament, again, because the New Testament comes from and speaks to a minority community under the Roman Empire, there's not a fully developed concept or system of laws and government institutionalized in the New Testament. The major legal information is about the arrest, trial, and crucifixion and burial of Jesus. And even with what little material there is legally, it always stresses, as in the Old and New Testament, like in the passage we just heard, the care of the poor and the needy within and outside the community of faith. Questions? We got 15 whole minutes, so ask away. Fire away. Yes, sir. It's a good question. The question is, why can't I preach David? I think that history and Christian theology and Jewish theology I think the book of Samuel is enormously courageous to include the Bathsheba incident. And that incident is told in a way, it's one of the best told stories in the Bible. It is not papered over. It is told in a way where David is immediately indicted by Nathan, and just in the way the story is untold, Bathsheba's not named, the word sent is over and over. The story begins with the words, "In the spring of the year when kings go out to battle, David took an afternoon nap." I mean, it is told in a way that indicts him. Having said that, he is such a dominant figure in the Old Testament. And, Christ is tied to him, both linearly and just in sort of stylistically, that it has been very, very easy for Jews and Christians to act as if David had a momentary slip where he was attracted to the beautiful young daughter of a family that lived next door, when it is really an abuse of power. It is abuse of his role as commander-in-chief. We never tell the story that he also had her husband killed, who was his General Mattis of the day. It was a rape, period. So it's just hard for me to... I find him and Paul to be probably the two most interesting characters in the Bible. And I preached him so much, and I was scheduled to preach him when the summer after all this broke, and I just couldn't do it. I didn't know what I'd say, even though I've acknowledged all that about him. So sometimes the best way to treat subjects is to just shut up about them, to just not treat them. You know, I hope I return to him someday. But I mean, you know, I had one person that I knew, not in this congregation, who was, I think, legitimately, was certainly in the news as a, you know, person that was involved in sexual, part of the Me Too movement, who was outed. And, you know, we had a person visiting the congregation when I made some reference to it that came up and thanked me for making reference to it, because she was also in the news as having blown the whistle on a boss. So that's why. I don't know. Yes, Ed.
How do we know what is the will and the way of God?
How do we know what's the will and way of God?
We don't have prophets telling us things. We read the Bible for one. You point out that the New Testament doesn't have very much in the Bible. So where do we get our...
Yeah. His question is, how do we know the will and way of God? Where do we get our laws today? I think that, I mean, the way I answer that as a Presbyterian is that we know, I mean, we seek to discern God's will through prayer, through reading of Scripture, through our theological tradition, through our experience of the community of faith. And that's not just, you know, working in the kitchen. It's actually the group study of Scripture and the group study of theology. And I think at our deepest moments, I mean, one of the good things about Westminster is I do think a lot of people have somebody in this church they trust and go to and can sort of talk about some of their most difficult issues. But ultimately, in our tradition, it's, you know, God alone is Lord of the conscience. So ultimately, you make up your mind in your relationship with God based on all this other stuff, including coming to Sunday school every week and worship, which I know you do. So, but it's, you know, there's no religions that promise you a manual, I don't think, are making an accurate promise. But certainly, you know, the teachings of Jesus, the Ten Commandments, these tried and true things throughout history that transcend our religion and transcend particular cultures are a really good starting point. So, yes, I'll get to you.
I guess beyond that, I have a sense like from the individual, then it's the consensus of the community of believers, of people with character. Because I think that although I individually may think A, and, you know, someone else thinks B, in the consensus of our community, we give A minus and B plus.
Okay.
And by doing that, then we move forward in some way. So I guess I think there's a community modification of the individual interpretation.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to vault. I think, I'm not sure you heard him, but the essence of what he was saying is that the consensus of a religious community of which you are part goes a long way towards helping you decide or at least accept a you know, what might be right or wrong. I do think that's part of what I was saying earlier about the way the law can function to actually help form our consciences. And I think you're right about that. I think where that breaks down is that now the religious community and certainly the Christian community is just so divided and is all over the map. It would be hard to say there is a consensus among Christians worldwide about, you know, what's right or wrong other than some very basic things. like, I wouldn't even know what they are. But within a congregation, you can hopefully find that, even within a tradition. I mean, when I was a minister that was a mentor to me in the 70s, who was a product of, you know, been in seminary in the 50s, used to use the phrase the mind of the church. And I think there probably used to be a mind of the church. I'm not sure there's a mind of the church now. That's very anything other than localized. I'm not sure. Well, but if it works, go for it. Okay. Larry, you've got a question?
Oh, I had a comment.
Oh, okay.
I think the primary answer to that question is it's your own responsibility, which is justifiable based on the fact that you have reason. If you have reason rather than make decisions for you.
Yes, reason is certainly an important part of it.
It's not based on what Eve did by eating the fruit.
Your certain reason is certain a part of it. And I know with your good Catholic background, that's where that comes from. And that's true. It's good. It's good. I think it is. Yeah, natural law. So other questions or comments? We've really got 5 minutes. So come on. Yes, Margaret. Okay. What would you add to it? Yeah, expand on that about Sharia law.
Well, so let's pick the wedding cake one. Regardless of where I view that
right.
Personally, if you say, well, the right thing is your belief is you don't like same-sex marriages, so you won't bake the cake or you support Hobby Lobby because they won't provide contraception.
Right.
Well, then so you are a Muslim and you say, well, the civil law.
Correct.
And you really have to take that step and support that also.
But
it's hard to draw
a line. Yeah, I agree. It's hard to draw a line. I think Sharia law is, you know, unfortunately in the news has, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of danger of Sharia law becoming the law of the United States of America, so it sort of gets misused. But if you are in a strict religious tradition of any kind, which Sharia law would be, then you have a real issue with that.
How do you feel about sacrificing virgins?
I'm not going to answer that. Did you have other questions? Yes, Mary.
The example I have in mind when I'm asking this question is that I found out that there is now a minister of Ignatius from Texas in the Presbyterian Church whose role is dealing with gun violence and the issues of gun violence, but we don't hear very much about it. And I'm just curious as to whether you feel that there is enough being done, enough being said publicly about issues like that in the main denominations.
Okay. My answer to that, and I'll be honest, is I think that because the remnant of Christianity, which is mainline Protestantism, we're now down to about 15% of the American population. And in almost all of those denominational traditions, there is a pretty high degree of focus on individual conscience and decision making. I think Presbyterians or Westminster does that more explicitly, but in Methodist churches and in congregational churches and even Episcopal, the church official positions, whether it's the local clergy or the denominational position papers or denominational executives, for the most part, don't have the power, it's almost time to go, to speak for individual members' beliefs. I mean, they can neither speak for them nor say, this is what you have to believe to be a good Presbyterian or a good Methodist or a good Congregationalist, unlike the older Catholic tradition. So I think the height of mainline Protestants' contribution to social justice was probably the civil rights movement. I think less so in Vietnam, but I didn't pay much attention to Vietnam when I was a kid. I was more aware of the civil rights movement. And I think since then, frankly, it is almost always on the left end of the spectrum, so I don't think it has credibility with a lot of our members. And I have people on the Hill that tell me it doesn't have credibility with them. And I know that's not what you don't... I know you don't want to hear that. but I don't think it's very effective. I mean, I don't rely on denominational resources to come to my conclusions simply because I think living in this area, I have access to better information than what denominations produce, honestly. And I know that's damning, but it's my honest opinion. And I don't know that's so. So I would say, I mean, when I started in the ministry, we had 1,200 people working in the Louisville office. We have about 200 now. I mean, the resources are just, you know, it's sort of a dying thing. And I think in America, you know, the greatest, I'm just going to go out on a limb, I guess, a historian's limb, and say, I think probably the greatest contribution that institutional Protestantism has made to American culture has been in the literacy that Puritanism brought. The emphasis on learning. I think that certainly the 19th century reform movements of abolitionism particularly and suffrage in as much as that was involved, and then I think the civil rights movement. And in almost all of those instances there were identifiable clergy or spokesperson that were, you know, whether it was Frederick Douglass or Martin Luther King or, you know, some of the abolitionist ministers in the 19th century that were national figures. And I think that's probably where the culture was more moved than by, I mean, the denominational offices are really a post-World War II creation. So I think what we don't have in America and have lacked for a long time are sort of national mainline Protestant voices that are able to get much consensus. And instead what we've had is sort of, you know, which we've always had, the power of positive thinking, the Norman Vincent Peale, Robert Schuller, now Joel Osteen, and now prosperity gospel. We've always had that, or we've had it for a couple of hundred years. And I think, you know, the fractured evangelical movement and some of the people that have just jumped thoroughly on President Trump's bandwagon. I mean, the religious right has had figures, but we have not in our tradition had them. So if we did, the story might be a little bit different, but I'm not sure we're very capable of it. Thank you all for coming. This has been wonderful. See you next week. Thank you for your question.